Does the Iowa Constitution protect the right to a so-called telemed abortion? That's a question currently before the Iowa Supreme Court. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we learn about several recent cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. In addition to the telemedicine abortion case, we'll talk about a case that looked at whether automated technology should issue speeding tickets. Several other cases on the docket for us this hour are legal analysts Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law and Ryan Copemans of Nyemaster Good. Cases before the Iowa Supreme Court that may affect your life. First, a look at this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Every half year or so, we like to look at what's going on at the Iowa Supreme Court, cases that may have a bearing on our lives, may change our lives, in fact. And we are doing that this hour with Todd Pettis, Associate Dean for Faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law in our Iowa City studio. Todd Pettis, welcome to the program again.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Ryan Copeman's with us in our Des Moines studio, attorney at Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. Ryan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me.
As always, as I look over these cases, it's fascinating to find out the personal stories behind these cases that end up in changing a law or having a law applied in a special way. So let's get right at it. We had in our first case yesterday, Planned Parenthood lawyers went before the Iowa Supreme Court, Ryan, and they were asking for more than more permission to continue using a controversial telemedicine system for dispensing abortion pills. Tell us about the origins of this case.
So this is where Iowa has been, I guess, a leader, the first in the nation to allow or to have Planned Parenthood set up a procedure by which a woman could go into one of their clinics at which a physician was not located. The woman would then talk to the physician on a video conference. The physician would ask questions. The nurse or assistant would then examine the patient, do an ultrasound, and after that, assuming everything was okay, the physician would press a button and a drawer would pop open, which contained an abortion-inducing drug. In 2010, a group petitioned the Iowa Board of Medicine to say this is not okay, this is not a safe procedure. This was a group that was opposed to abortion, and the board took no action. Fast forward now to 2013, the Board of Medicine was composed of different members, those who had now been appointed by Governor Branstad. A similar petition went before the board. The board took that petition up, and ultimately, after hearing public comment, passed a rule, which says that, no, you have to have an in-person examination. So essentially, this procedure has now been banned in Iowa. Under this rule, that's what's being challenged.
Mm-hmm. So any more specifics on, because safety is cited as the reason this should not be permitted, any more specifics provided by the Iowa Board of Medicine as to why this is an unsafe procedure to provide it in a telemedicine fashion?
Well, the record is, I'll use the word thin, but usually boards don't have to necessarily lay out a lot of evidence to explain their decisions. They give anecdotal evidence of why this could be a problem, why you need a doctor there, what can happen, what kind of all these medical terms, which I'll admit I don't understand, atopic pregnancies, certain kinds of things in which it would be good to have a doctor there. And Iowa law specifically provides that only physicians can perform abortion. So there's that kind of extra statutory requirement that's placed there. There are several medical groups that did come in that said, no, we don't think this is any more dangerous than seeing an in-person physician. But the doctors and other members of the medical board decided otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, telemedicine, if people aren't acquainted with it, procedures not involving abortion are, I don't know if routine, but also in a variety of medical areas, telemedicine is accepted and not objected to?
That's right. And that's when the Planned Parenthood then went to court, and that was one of their arguments to challenge this law. They say, look, you're treating abortion differently than you are other types of procedures, and you're, in fact, encouraging telemedicine in other areas, and therefore this is obviously not so Planned Parenthood says this is not to look out for the safety of patients, but this is all about opposition to abortion.
This case was just heard yesterday before the Iowa Supreme Court. Any indication, hints, anything to go on about how the court is looking at this, how they will decide it?
No. Usually I walk away. I listen to the oral argument, and usually I walk away from those arguments with a pretty good idea of how the court's going to come out. If there was such thing as a betting market on the Iowa Supreme Court, I'd probably be able to quit my day job. I would not, however, bet on this case. I really don't know how it's going to come out. But whichever way it comes out, it could have very broad implications that go well beyond telemed abortion and well beyond abortion. There's two main arguments that that Planned Parenthood is using to attack this new rule. The first is they say that the Board of Medicine didn't properly follow the Iowa Administrative Procedures Act, which is essentially a very broad statute that says here's the process that agencies have to follow when they pass rules, when they create law. Because that's maybe the secret. What most people don't know is that a lot of the law and regulations that govern our conduct aren't passed by the legislature. They're passed by agencies. And so these kinds of processes are very important. But normally, courts will defer to the agency. If the agency says this is unsafe, and the courts, one of the justices yesterday said, well, look, I went to law school. I didn't go to medical school. And I can relate to that. As we were talking earlier, Ben, I can tell you, I don't really know what the safety issues here are. That's not because perhaps they're not out there, just I have no idea. It will be interesting to see, though, whether because of this sensitive subject area, whether the court digs in a little bit more on the reasons that the board gave for passing this, if they require a little bit more evidence than they normally decide. Mm-hmm. If they do that, that could obviously have an effect on other kinds of agency cases, not just abortion cases.
And we should point out here that this is particularly of interest to the potential impact on Iowans living in rural areas away from centers where they may not have these services available.
That's right. That's what Planned Parenthood is arguing, that it takes some time to drive to these areas. And they're saying, well, look, there's a very limited amount of time in which a woman can get what they call a medical abortion, which is where they take the pill to induce the drug. Otherwise, it has to be surgical. So they're saying that small window and then the ability to travel can put a roadblock in front of some women. That then jumps into the constitutional argument. The U.S. Supreme Court has held for a long time that states and the federal government cannot place a, quote, undue burden on the right of a woman to receive an abortion. That means that they can place a lot of types of regulations so long as it is not a significant obstacle. Mm-hmm. The question then is whether this, the drive is a significant obstacle.
Ryan Copeland's with us of Nymaster Good in Des Moines. Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law, you wanted to jump in here on this case as well?
Well, just very briefly, I watched the oral arguments this morning because the Iowa Supreme Court has them up on their website, and I will say that according to the YouTube count that will tell you how many times a video has been viewed, it had been viewed 13 times. This is clearly an issue of interest to a lot of people from a lot of different quarters on both sides of the issue, and when the ruling comes down, there will be a lot of interest in it. And so I would just strongly encourage people who do have an interest in it to go take a look. It's about a 45-minute video. You can spend as much time there as you want. But I was really struck that only a dozen people had seen it. Now, the arguments were just yesterday, but even some of the older arguments, some of the cases we're looking at today, the YouTube counts show that they've been viewed 4 times, 5 times. The public is just not engaging with this service that the Supreme Court makes available. And I would strongly encourage those who have interest in these cases to take a look because they're intelligible. It's not a bunch of legalese. I think 80-90% of those arguments anyone who's listening to this radio program would be able to watch the oral arguments yesterday in that Planned Parenthood case and be able to follow the great majority of it and really start to get a feel of where the justices are, where the parties are, and what the real pivots are in the argument.
And that is surprising also in light of the fact that this is an Iowa Supreme Court case that has garnered national attention. Now, depending on what the court decides here, isn't it true that this can be used as a precedent in other state cases?
Yes, that's true. This case is focusing on Iowa law, and so it won't bind anybody in other cases. But other states will certainly look to it as informative and possibly persuasive.
On the question of whether telemedicine is safe in this issue, in this...
Sure. How it can be handled as a regulatory matter, and also how the Iowa Constitution should be read. There's an argument in this case being made by Planned Parenthood that under the Iowa Constitution, there ought to be stronger rights to abortion than there currently are under federal law. The Iowa Supreme Court hasn't really grappled with that yet, and they may or may not in this particular case. But that's an important issue here and elsewhere. And
highly controversial issue. Ryan Copeman's, any idea when should we expect a decision from the Iowa Supreme Court?
I think we'll see this one go until the very end of their term. This is kind of like the U.S. Supreme Court. The controversial cases come at the end, and I expect probably July, possibly into August.
Ryan Copeman's with us, and Todd Pettis, our legal expertise, as we look at a number of interesting cases before the Iowa Supreme Court this hour. Todd Pettis, let me ask you about the case State v. Morris that I think was decided, a case that involves, decided in January, as a matter of fact. It's involved an inmate named Bo Morris, convicted of first-degree robbery and second-degree sexual assault in 2004. While serving time, he earned money in part in prison to pay restitution to his victim. And what did he want to do?
Well, it's interesting, and just to take a step back here on the history, because it bears on the program that is at issue in this case. It used to be, prior to the early 1900s, that prisons were largely self-financed, and they did that through prison labor. Prisoners could be told that they're going to make certain products. Those goods could be sold. That then becomes a primary funding source for prisoners. Well, during the Great Depression, that became seen as very problematic because private industries and people who are not prisoners who are looking for jobs find themselves in competition with this very cheap labor. And so Congress responded. And in the late 1920s and early 1930s, Congress passed a couple of statutes that eventually made it illegal to sell goods across state lines that had been made with prison labor. But then they've chipped away with that with very exceptions. For the example, they've said, well, if government is the customer, if the government is the entity buying the products, then that's okay. Well, the 1970s and 1980s, as part of kind of a prison reform movement, federal law changed, and it set up a program whereby states could, if they wished, partner with private industry, bring those private industries in, have prisoners work for those private industries for market wages, so they're not working below market, they're not in competition with locals, and a variety of other conditions have to be met. So it became possible for a prisoner to earn, you know, as in this case, $10, $11 an hour. The prisoner can keep, under federal law, very little of that, and in fact, under Iowa law, the prisoner will keep 20% of those wages, but the rest of it goes somewhere else. And this case involves involved a fight about where the rest of that somewhere else was going to go. As you say, Bo Morris had been convicted of robbery and sexual assault in 2003, got access to a condominium neighbor's apartment by asking to use her computer. Things went bad from there. He was caught, sentenced to two consecutive 25 years imprisonment, and key here, ordered to pay restitution in the amount of $16,000. Some of that would go to the victim. Some of it would go to the local court system to reimburse it for costs they had incurred in carrying out his trial. Now, he's gotten a job in prison through this program and for H&H Trailers and came to be making $10, $11 an hour. So then the question is, who's going to get that? Okay, well, under the Iowa statute, it says, well, here's how his wages will be distributed. The first thing that happens is the employer withholds taxes, right? 20% of it then goes to the inmate, but just 20%, okay? The rest is going somewhere else. something like 5% goes to a victim compensation fund, which is not a fund targeted at this particular victim of this crime, but rather is a fund that the state uses to pay, for example, for the medical exams that are performed sometimes on crime victims in order to gather evidence, to train people who provide services to crime victims and so forth. And then the statute sets up a list of priorities and says, okay, now the rest of the money should be distributed in accordance with this list of priorities. First up, child support or spousal support if you've been ordered to pay it. Mr. Morris had not been ordered to pay it. The next thing on the list is restitution. Below that is the Department of Corrections, which can keep a chunk in order to pay for supervising these inmates who work for private industries. And then below that is the State of Iowa General Fund. Well, what Mr. Morris wanted to do is he wanted to say, I want to pay more toward restitution. I'd like to get that paid off. Looking down the road, I anticipate asking the governor to let me out early. I'd like to have my debt paid fully by the time I make that request. And so instead of paying 15% toward restitution, which was the original agreement, I want to increase that to 50%, 5-0, to 50%. And the state resisted. It's not hard to understand why they would resist. Among other things, the more that goes to restitution, the less that is available to go toward the other things on the list, including the Department of Corrections itself and the state's general fund.
And it also sets a precedent for an inmate having control.
Sure. Absolutely. To be able to dictate, well, this much is going to go here, this much is going to go there. And it went to the Iowa Supreme Court, and the Iowa Supreme Court ruled unanimously in favor of the prisoner and said the statute is clear. It lays out, using the language of priority, you know, this comes first, and then if any money is left, then it goes to this, and then it goes to that. On that list, restitution shows up higher than the Department of Corrections and the state of Iowa itself. And so the Supreme Court said if he wants 50%, to go to restitution, then 50% is going to go to restitution. One of the interesting things about this case, I think, then it opens several questions for the state, both in this program and in similar programs. One question, for example, is should anything be going to the Department of Corrections or to the state of Iowa until restitution has been paid in full?
Mm-hmm.
After all, if it's a higher priority item, Why does the Department of Corrections and the State of Iowa General Fund get anything until the victim and the others who are the recipients of the restitution money have been paid in full? And I think lawmakers are likely to take a look at that. And then there's another program, a work release program, where people are not incarcerated, but they're out in maybe what you might call halfway houses or residential facilities. And there's thousands of those prisoners. And there's another statute that similarly lays out some priorities where, again, restitution is high on the list. And so we may see, we may not, but it's possible that we'll see some rethinking in the coming months about just what the status quo is. What's going to be the ordinary setup for prisoners and the wages they earn? Is it become automatic that we pay off restitution first and then the Department of Corrections and the state of Iowa starts to get some money?
I wonder if in this case the victim's view on increasing this was ever in play, or was the victim heard from at all?
It wasn't in the record that I saw. It certainly wasn't referenced in the Supreme Court opinion. One can imagine that your ordinary victim would rather be paid sooner rather than later. And so in some sense, the victim's interests here are being kind of pitted against those of the larger state of Iowa. The Des Moines Register has done, or maybe it was the Associated Press with the Des Moines Register, has done some reporting on this and has pointed out that we're not talking about a small sum of money. I think it was year 2013 that the reporting covered, and in excess of $1 million went to the Department of Corrections in the state to share, and about $500,000 went to restitution, under, you know, what the arrangement had been prior to this case. But I do think this case is going to cause policymakers to take a look at what the normal arrangement is for prisoners who work and who's going to get those wages first, keeping in mind that the inmate, him or herself, is only going to get 20%. The fight is over. Who else gets the wages that they earn through their labor?
Todd Pettis is with us of the University of Iowa College of Law. Ryan Copeman's attorney at Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. We're talking about a handful of cases recently or presently before the Iowa Supreme Court, that case just talking about State v. Morris. Before our break, let me turn to you, Ryan, and ask you about a case, City of Sioux City v. Jacob Smith, if that's the way you pronounce it. Looking at the question that we've talked about many times on this talk show about speeding tickets being given by cameras, automated systems.
Yeah, speed cameras, red light cameras, the things that the public loves to hate and that cities love to love, I guess. This is the second time the Iowa Supreme Court has heard about a challenge to a automatic traffic violation ticketing system. The first time they said, yes, this is something that cities can indeed have. This is not necessarily a state issue that is only left for the state. That was a few years ago. This time we come back and we have actually an attorney who gets a ticket and decides that he's going to fight because the statute, he says, it's not fair. It violates my due process rights because the state or the city doesn't need to prove that I was driving. What if somebody else was driving and it's not my fault and that's unconstitutional for you to fine me? The Supreme Court unanimously said that is not unconstitutional. But in doing that, the court left open the door for a future challenge. And so we might see this again.
Mm-hmm. So when he said, you know, anybody could have been driving my car, the photo, I guess that was photo evidence, saw the license plate. That's how they identified the car, but not a face or other so personally identifying feature there, too. Did this Jacob Smith offer any evidence that someone else had driven his car, been lent his car, or stole his car?
He did not, and that was the weakness in his case. He didn't come forward and say, well, you know, my spouse is driving. Of course, that would have been interesting, throw your spouse under the bus. He didn't say my son or anyone else is driving. He just said, I think the law as written is generally unfair, and the court said, look, without evidence that you weren't driving, we're not going to take up that issue at this time. So perhaps it will in the future. I think, though, that we'll see the ordinance upheld again. And if this is going to be, these cameras are going to be taken away, it won't be as a constitutional matter, but will have to be as a statutory matter.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting. I was caught by a speeding camera when I lived in Europe, in Germany, actually. And I was not aware of it at the time, but a few days later, a thermopaper photograph in the mail showed up with me in my mailbox. A fine I had to pay, but it was not only the license plate, it was me peering out of the windshield, certainly identifiable there. So I guess I haven't looked at what you actually get here in Iowa when you are given a speeding ticket.
Did you flee Germany or did you then?
No, I paid my fine and I was a good citizen of that country. So in opening, we have just a minute or so. So they left open the possibility of other challenges, Ryan. So we would expect other challenges to speed cameras.
Yeah, next person comes along and they say, as this guy did not, well, you know, my friend was driving. I loaned him my car. And how the statute is written, you can do that. In Sioux City, you can say, I nominate someone else is driving. But that nomination really isn't effective unless that person admits that they were driving the car. And so it's very hard to prove that somebody else should be responsible. But I think the broader question would be, why is it the state's burden to prove that anybody was driving? Isn't it just okay to fine you because you are the owner of your car and you should take responsibility for who's driving your car? And in fact, we've been doing that for years and years and years. It's called a parking ticket.
Exactly. That's crossed our minds. Yeah, parking ticket. Nobody says, I won't pay that because I wasn't actually, that was my spouse or my son or whoever in the car. Right, yeah. Okay, we'll come back. Very interesting. Cases before the Iowa Supreme Court, all attached to stories. People bringing grievances to courts, and it's elevated to the Iowa Supreme Court in this case. We're talking about a half dozen of them, and when we come back, we'll talk about an interesting case that stems from a trial where there were two doctors who were defendants in a case, and one of the jurors fainted, and one of these doctors came to help. Well, that provided a complication that we'll explain when we get back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law. Ryan Kopmans of Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. Back in a moment. So good to have you back with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Ryan Copemans, attorney at Nyemaster Good in Des Moines, and Todd Pettis, associate dean for faculty at H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. They visit us periodically to talk about cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. In this case, we also deal with the U.S. Supreme Court at some points. But today, we're focusing on cases recently decided or currently before the Iowa Supreme Court. We have several cases to get through in this final half hour. I'd like to ask you, Todd, about a case called Jack v. Booth. This is an interesting story that I'd like you to tell of two doctors who were defendants in a case.
Yes, and as you alluded to before the break, it's kind of the case of the fainting juror. And the way the story unfolds is that a woman named Mary Jack, and because her last name is also a man's first name, I'll just take the liberty of referring to her as Mary. Mary was pregnant, about 35 weeks pregnant, and began to experience pelvic pain. So she went to the Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines, where she was treated by a doctor named Dr. Jennifer Booth. Dr. Booth tried to induce labor, no success, and said we need to move quickly and performed an emergency cesarean section or C-section. Mary lost some blood. There were some complications requiring then a second surgery, a more significant surgery, a hysterectomy, in fact. During that second surgery, an anesthesiologist named Dr. John Sweetman provided services, and when inserting the needle into her arm, apparently, or at least allegedly, the needle did not go perfectly into the vein, so that when the IV fluids came down through the tube, it went into the surrounding tissue. Her arm became swollen and discolored, and that necessitated then a third surgery, this time to deal with her arm. Mary was not happy with the treatment that she had received, so she filed lawsuits, separate claims against these two doctors. First against Dr. Booth, saying that if you had taken care of me better in the first surgery, I would not have had to have had a second surgery. And then to the anesthesiologist, if you had performed the IV, done a better job with the IV, I would not have had these problems with my arm, necessitating then a third surgery. So those two cases were tried together in front of the same jury, even though she had different claims and different factual story for each. And so Dr. Booth is on the stand talking, I think, as I understand it from watching the oral arguments, Dr. Booth is talking about the details of one of the surgeries, and one of the jurors faints, and another juror kind of raises his or her hand and says, you know, we've got a problem here. So everything comes to a stop. Dr. Sweetman, the anesthesiologist, who's not on the stand but is clearly in the room, jumps up, goes, and begins to provide aid to this juror. It's not clear what Dr. Booth does, but apparently she stays in the witness stand. Perhaps she stands up. Maybe at some point along the way she offers the fainted juror a cup of water. But for the large part, she's watching Dr. Sweetman provide this aid. After a couple of minutes, the rest of the jurors are excused. And so then there's about a 15-20 minute period as the juror wakes up. And so forth. And then that juror, the fainted juror, is excused. She doesn't continue to serve on this jury. Mary's attorney makes a motion, says, we need a new trial. We need to start over in front of a whole new jury because let's look at what's happened here. Dr. Sweetman, good for him for getting up. I'm not criticizing him in any way for providing aid. He did exactly what one would want a doctor to do. But these jurors have now seen Dr. Sweetman as a hero, and by extension has come to see a vivid illustration of doctors as heroes, and that would extend to Dr. Booth as well. And so we think that we need a brand new jury. I need to start all over again because this jury is now going to be biased in favor of doctors. The trial court rejected that. The jury ultimately ruled in favor of both doctors. Okay, mm-hmm. So Mary goes up to the Court of Appeals and says, I want a new trial. And the Court of Appeals agrees and says, yes, you should get a new trial. Dr. Sweetman does not appeal that ruling. So he is set for a new trial if the parties don't settle. Dr. Booth, however, the one who was on the stand who did not provide the aid, she appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and then that's what yielded.
To the Iowa Supreme Court.
To the Iowa Supreme Court, yeah, mm-hmm. The Iowa Supreme Court. And that's what yielded the ruling here. I'll just note first that after the court recites the facts, one of the very first things that they say is, we can only grant relief to the parties who are in front of us. Dr. Sweetman is not here, so we can't grant him any relief. I think that they were just they're setting up then a discussion, which then occupies a few pages where they say it's possible to grant relief to one defendant but not another. But I have to say, when I read that, the thought crossed my mind that if I were in Dr. Sweetman's shoes, I would read that and think, boy, even though I did have a tougher case because I was the one preparing or providing the aid, you know, should I have appealed? And who knows, maybe I would have won. But in any event, the focus is on Dr. Booth, the OBGYN, and the Supreme Court unanimously finds that no new trial is needed. This notion that by seeing one doctor, Dr. Sweetman, provide aid, that somehow that biases the jury in favor of all doctors, the court just didn't buy it. And so Justice Mansfield, for example, who wrote the opinion and also at oral argument, he said, well, you know, Mary has a doctor who's testifying as an expert witness on her behalf. Are we to think then that this bias in favor of doctors would carry over to her? The court just basically lined up behind the jury and said, we trust the jury to have handled this rationally, and we don't think they were unduly biased. No new trial for Mary on her claim against Dr. Booth.
Jack V. Booth, the name of that case, as we go through several cases recently before the Iowa Supreme Court, currently before the Iowa Supreme Court. Todd Pettis with us. You're just listening to him if you've just joined us from the University of Iowa College of Law. Ryan Copeman's of Nyemaster. Good. Ryan, I'm going to have you be careful with this next one because it is a case called In the Interest of D.S. It involves actually nothing to laugh about, but some alleged harassment. Whether harassment took place when a foul-mouthed teenager stepped out of a bus, had a colorful exchange with another student leaving the bus. Tell us about this one.
Well, I don't want to, as you said, I have to be careful here. I don't want to break any FCC regulations. I don't want to get you in trouble, Ben. So I'm going to give two disclaimers here. First of all, the case is in re DS. Whenever we have a juvenile case, and this is a case of a 15-year-old, what the court does is it refers to the teenager, the minor, by their initials, DS. So I'm going to do the same thing. And the second is there's some swear words in here. This is kind of your, unfortunately, typical teenage banter. Maybe not typical, maybe a little atypical. But I'm just going to, you know, provide my own FCC protection beep here. So whenever I say beep, that is the B word.
Very
so
good.
The audience can understand that. So this is essentially the Iowa Supreme Court becomes a principal's office, as I phrase it. This was a criminal prosecution, though, of a juvenile for harassment. And harassment occurs under Iowa law when a person purposefully and without legitimate purpose has personal contact with another person with the intent to threaten, intimidate, or alarm that other person. So that sounds pretty serious, right? I mean, you're convicted of that. You've done something very bad. Now I'm going to tell you, I'm going to read from the court's opinion about what this defendant, this juvenile, did. Here's the victim's story. I was walking home from the bus and DS yelled, "T-beep." So I turned around and thought she was talking to me. I told her, "What?" And then she said, "I wasn't talking to you, you fat, skanky beep. I'm way better than you and prettier than you, and I'm not desperate like you to sleep with the bus driver." The victim replied, "I don't care about looks. At least I have a heart." And DS responded, "Whatever you skanky beep." So obviously not in a very nice story. Unfortunately, it's something that does happen in our schools. But the victim went home and was upset, told her mother, and then who called the police. And this case is about this one interaction, but it sounds like there had been a history with these two and that there had been some, I guess what you would generally refer to as bullying, going on back a lot of years. But apparently the prosecutor thought that this was bad enough, and she did bring this harassment charge. And the juvenile court found that harassment had indeed occurred, and she was convicted. the court's rationale was kind of interesting. It said, well, she didn't really threaten her with any physical harm, but she intimidated her. And specifically, the court looked at the term intimidate, and it can mean to make timid or fearful. And timid could mean to make lacking in courage or self-confidence. And so because, according to the juvenile court, DS made the victim, quote, lack self-confidence in her relations with the opposite sex about her body, she was convicted of harassment. Hmm. That was appealed to the Iowa Court of Appeals, who said, no, that's not what intimidate means in this context. It's much more akin to what you think of as a threat, a bodily harm. The Iowa Supreme Court then heard the case and said, well, actually, we don't think this 15-year-old girl intended to engage the victim, and so we're just not going to call this harassment. We're just, essentially, what you saw the court was, I didn't follow the opinion perfectly, to be honest. I think they just said, look, she didn't mean to engage the teenage girl. This isn't what this statute's about. So the case itself is not very important. But step back, the broader picture, I think, really what this case is about, two things. One, how did a case like this, in which a paragraph I read to you, get all the way up to the Iowa Supreme Court? I think it's a little bit of a problem that we don't have laws to effectively deal with these kinds of out of school. This happened as she was walking home from the bus, to deal with bullying. And so what you saw here is a prosecutor who felt like she had the choice to take no action or take this to court. And that's how we end up with the Iowa Supreme Court becoming the principal's office.
Mm-hmm. And would the court have considered the question of if they had ruled that this was harassment, that this takes place numerous times every day, sorts of conversations every day across Iowa and across the nation?
They certainly could have. And I think that's why you see harassment in this particular statute is a very heavy hammer right. to put down on this young woman. And I think that's why they interpreted it the way they did. They wanted to really avoid this statute applying. And, you know, perhaps in the future there will be laws that will be able to deal with these situations more delicately.
What about any connections this case, the ruling may have to the concern over cyberbullying? We have had cases across the nation here in Iowa where cyberbullying has resulted in real harm, including suicide.
Well, that brings up the bullying legislation and the bullying issues that we've been talking about and who deals with it. So does the school have the power to deal with this? You know, that's kind of a debate and somewhat of a free speech debate about whether this happens off of school property, whether the effects of it spill into school property. Some people think that school officials aren't able to deal with this. And so then the only other option is to turn to the prosecutor and to do what the prosecutor did here, which is very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to a couple of other cases. We can get in actually a trio of cases. Todd Pettis, tell us about these cases that were they all decided together in December at the Supreme Court?
They were decided together, and Justice Wiggins wrote the opinion in each of the three cases. One of them is State versus Brown, the other is State versus Dudley, and State versus Waquez or Jacquez. They all involve claims of sexual abuse against young girls. The girls in the three cases were around 10 years old, give or take. And they had, of course, different experiences. They weren't together when it happened. One of them took a family trip from Minnesota down to Iowa with her grandfather. Another one went and spent the night at her stepsister's house, and the stepsister was then engaged to a man. In all of these cases, another one involved the boyfriend of the mother. In all cases, we've got these young girls who are coming into contact with men and all saying that one form or another of sexual abuse happened. And two of the cases involved inappropriate touching while the kids were spending the night on the floor. Another involved a claim of repeated acts of sexual intercourse over a period of years. And in all three cases, charges of sexual assault were brought against these men. And they were all separately tried, and they were all convicted. The Iowa Supreme Court took these three cases because they all have a common denominator.
And
the common denominator is, what role exactly can expert witnesses play and not play when they're on the stand talking about these kids and whether they are to be believed?
Oh, and so we can get a psychologist saying, how much kids make up, fantasize about things, or not to say that any of these cases were that case, but that kids make up things all the time on one side and the other wouldn't say, kids generally do not lie about things like this.
Exactly. And the line that the law draws is that expert witnesses are there to share specialized knowledge that your typical juror might not know. And so, for example, in this setting, when a child has been sexually abused, how do they commonly behave afterwards? What are some behavioral manifests? Do they start to dress differently, behave differently, cut their hair? You know, what typically happens? Okay, and your typical juror might not know that. On the other hand, it is the jury's job to decide whether each individual is to be believed and then make the decision about what actually happened. And what happened in these three cases was that experts, whether psychologists or forensic interviewers who have encounters with these young girls early on to decide whether the law enforcement ought to get more heavily involved, they took the stand and they said things like, you know, here are the signs of sexual abuse. Here's what you might expect. And so far, that's fine. And then they said things, and I'm talking in generality, so I can talk about all three cases at once. There's little nuances between them. But as a general matter, that they would say things like, the prosecutor would say, well, did this particular young girl's behavior, was her behavior consistent with that of a child that had been sexually abused? And the expert would say, yes, it had been, her behavior is consistent with abuse. Or in another one of the cases, one of the experts had said, I concluded that she ought to be kept away from her grandfather and should be placed in therapy. And the jury heard that. And in all three cases, the Supreme Court found that error had occurred and that new trials were required because I think in all three cases, they used the phrase, a very fine line, okay? The expert witness can say, as a general matter, how a person behaves after abuse, okay? But they cannot then take their expertise and whatever aura of credibility and scientific certitude that they carry as an expert, they cannot then say effectively to point to the little girl in the courtroom and say, and that little girl is telling the truth. That's the line that they're trying to police. And so it's left, what we end up is with kind of a dance where the expert will say, it's typical for a person who's a child who's been abused to do the following thing. She dresses in layers of clothing, she cuts her hair, she begins to act very boyish, as the testimony said in one case. We then would turn to another witness, not the expert, another witness to say, so tell us how this child behaved. Well, she cut her hair, she dresses in layers, but you leave it then to the jury to draw that seemingly obvious connection, but the expert cannot be the one to draw that connection.
Seems like a line that across the nation would have to be there. Do people have a clear line that, for instance, that the Iowa Supreme Court here decided? Is that a gray area all across the country? I don't know if you looked into that. But
no. Well, Justice Waterman, joined by Justice Zager, Justice Waterman wrote a really nice concurrence in one of these cases precisely on this point to say, you know, the line that Iowa is drawing here is not idiosyncratic or anything. A lot of other jurisdictions are grappling with the same problem and are drawing similar lines. And so he canvasses what a number of other states are doing. And they're all trying to walk this line between, on the one hand, giving the jury specialized knowledge that they can use, but not letting experts take their great credibility and then start to comment on whether a particular witness is or is not telling the truth. That's supposed to be the jury's job.
Todd Pettis is with us of the University of Iowa College of Law, and Ryan Copeman's attorney at Nymaster Good. We're winding up the hour. I think we have time for one more case. If I can turn to you, Todd, on this one. This is a case we have about 3 minutes to talk about this. An Iowa lawyer who was pulled over, suspected of driving under the influence of alcohol. Tell us this story quickly.
Yeah, it was in the area of Ankeny, Iowa. David Hellstrom is the attorney. He was pulled over. The officer smelled alcohol, watery eyes, and so forth, suspected that Mr. Hellstrom had been drinking, tried to administer some field sobriety tests, and I think Mr. Hellstrom may have started to try to do those but then refused to cooperate further, and then he was arrested and taken back to the station. He's back at the station. It's the middle of the night, and Mr. Hellstrom says, can I call my attorney? And the officer who supervised him says, sure. And so he tries. Now it's the middle of the night. He has a hard time getting anybody on the phone, but eventually he gets an attorney on the phone. And he says to the officer, can I have some privacy? And the officer says, and here's the key thing, he says, not on the phone, okay? So can I have a private conversation here with my attorney? And the officer says, not on the phone. Now, the statute that's lurking behind that is a statute that says that if the prisoner wishes to have an in-person, you know, face-to-face encounter with an attorney before taking a breathalyzer test, they may do so. But not when it's on the telephone. If the person's talking to their attorney on the telephone, then the statute does not guarantee any privacy in that conversation. And so the issue in front of the Supreme Court in that case was the officer, when once alerted that this person wanted to talk privately with his attorney, was the officer obliged to say, if she comes down here personally, then yes.
And this officer did not in that case. We have a few seconds left. How did the court decide?
The court said the officer is obliged to tell. Once the person indicates that they want to talk with their attorney, the officer is obliged to say, you have a right to talk confidentially with them, but it's got to be face-to-face.
Okay, Todd Pettis, thank you for taking quickly us through that last case. Todd Pettis with us, Associate Dean for Faculty in the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Ryan Copeman's attorney at Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. As always, fascinating cases, how our law is created and maintained and decided by our courts. Thank you, Todd. Thank you, Ryan, for coming into our studios today.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and also thanks to Juliet Davis. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Join us again tomorrow for a News Buzz edition of the program.